My name is Bob Miller. I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And I'm temporarily living in Phoenix, Arizona. Probably going to move out next month. As I get into my story, you'll know more about that. Usually at an AA convention, after the whole thing is over, I always hear people standing in the aisles out there, and they're saying, boy, the Al-Anon speaker was the sickest one of them all. Do you notice that? And they always say that at every AA convention, so. Last night I seen Dennis up here, and I thought, Dennis, the black poor kid from the South, he's going to be the sickest one of them all, I can tell. And he got up here, and he wasn't at all. He was a rather normal, average guy. But then I rode in with Bruce from the airport. And I thought, well, Bruce is going to take this away from me. I'm not going to have that title this time. Bruce didn't do that either. Bruce was relatively average, normal, intelligent guy. So, Harriet, it's going to be up to you. I got one little joke I just heard coming up here. Forrest Gump died and he went to heaven, and he was come up to the gate, and St. Peter stopped him at the gate and said, you're Forrest Gump, aren't you? And he said, yes, sir, I is. And he said, well, you know, I don't think you as stupid as people thought you were. And we have a little quiz that we give people before you come in here, because we have a special place for people who can't pass this little quiz. And so if you don't mind, and Forrest says, I don't mind. And they said, well, the first question is, how many days of the week start with a T? And Forrest Gump scratched his head and said, four. St. Peter said, four? How'd you get four? And he said, well, it's Tuesday, Thursday, today, and tomorrow. And St. Peter said, well, I guess so. I guess that could be all right. He said, now, here's really a tough one. How many seconds are there in a year? And Forrest scratched his head again, and he said, 12. And he said, Forrest, how'd you get 12? And he said, well, the 2nd of January, 2nd of February, 2nd of March. He said, well, I've got a really tough one for you now, and hardly anybody ever gets this one right. And he said, what is God's real name? And Forrest scratched his head for a minute, and he said, Andy. And he said, well, how did you get Andy? And he said, well, Andy helps me, and he walks with me, and he talks to me, and he loves me. And so, of course, St. Peter said, come on in, you're home. Yeah. I was born in Indiana, up a little town called Decatur, up a little south of Fort Wayne, up in the northeast corner. And back in those days, it was cold, just like it is here now. My father was just happened to be an alcoholic, or I don't know if he was an alcoholic. He was certainly a drunk, and he did that very well. And he was German ancestry, and my mother was German ancestry, and they lived together, and they battled together for 42 years all together until he died. And that's what they did all the while we were growing up. My father was drunk every day that I ever knew him. I don't believe that he ever had a sober day. And my mother didn't take that very well. And when he would come home, we would know whether his being home in the condition that he was in was going to be acceptable or not. And about once a week or so, we would see mother preparing for the battle, and she always did. And she would pace back and forth, and she would get ready, and she'd say, not this time. He's not getting away with it this time, you know. I've been holding supper for 3 hours. And by the way, if you came from an alcoholic home, you know that supper is the biggest problem that you have, because it's the biggest control issue there is in an alcoholic home, because the alcoholic is always required to be home for supper, and he never makes it to supper. 90% of the battles are fought over supper. But we would watch, and then she would meet him at the door, nose to nose, and the only way he could get in was to hit her. And we knew that was going to happen every time. And the only one that never knew was mother. She never figured out that that's what was going to happen. And There was five of us kids. I have three sisters and a brother. And as soon as we were old enough, we headed outside, and we just stayed outside. We just never came back in, except when we had to. My mother kept the house perfectly clean for my father, because for her it was something that she did. The nap on the carpet, I mean, when we walked in the house, we took our shoes off at the door, and we walked around on the wood side of the carpet so you didn't step on the carpet and mat it down. And we were always told that the furniture belonged to them and it did not belong to the children. We were welcome to use our part of it, but not to touch anything without permission. And she kept the house meticulous. She washed the walls, washed the ceiling. She did that once a week. That's what she did. That was her insanity. And of course, my father was a workaholic and a drunk besides. And he would go off to work at 6 o'clock in the morning, come home at 10, 11 o'clock every night, and in the same condition. I don't know how much of that time he spent at work, but that's how much time he spent gone. And the only thing that you knew as a kid was you never wanted to get caught in the house, and I never did. And I thought that was pretty bad at the time, you know, and emotionally that's pretty destructive for a small kid. But the worst was yet to come, because they happened to be Catholic, and they sent me to a Catholic school. And of course, it's not like that anymore. I'm sure it's not like that anymore. But back then, we had this little order of nuns from, I think they were German, too. Most of the town was German. And I think two of them, I think, was the same nuns that Hitler had. But they tried to teach us, you know, the right things. I'm sure that their heart was in the right place, but it was just too complicated for a little kid to catch on. I just, you know, I tried to catch on to it, and I couldn't. Everything was a sin, and I tried to figure out what was venial sins and what was mortal sins, and the venial sins, every little thought that you had, everything you did, every little cuss word you said, every time you did or thought anything wrong, it was a venial sin. And of course, you get this little mark on your soul, and sometime you would have to go to purgatory, and you'd have to spend a certain amount of time there, and unless you did indulgences. And indulgences, they had little prayer cards and stuff that you could say, and you do these indulgences, you get time off your purgatory time. But where it really got complicated was they never told you about how much time was involved here. And so you never knew when you had a venial sin whether you're going to do 2 weeks in purgatory or 3 weeks or whatever. And on a little card, you know, sometimes it'd say you get 40 hours off purgatory time. But it was really complicated for a little kid. And I just couldn't get onto it. And then I got a paper route at 10, you know, and they indulgence, you could put a quarter in and light candles, and that would give you so much time off. But that didn't seem to be paying off, because I didn't know how much time I had, and I did have a limit of quarters. So I just give up on the whole thing. You know, and that was my God experience at the time. God did not work very well in our home. Of course, they taught you that if you pray to Jesus and if you pray hard enough and you're good enough, all good things will come to you. And that's not true when you live in an alcoholic home and you're a little kid. It's just not true. They never mentioned anything about they have to pray for themselves. They have to do something themselves that you can't change them. You can't remake them. You can't change your life. And so I grew up just naturally thinking that God hated us. And we didn't have a whole lot of money. And just like Dennis, I never had a haircut except for my mother give us all a haircut. And she only had one size bowl, so the line just moved up as she got older. But we never went to the dentist. We never done any of those things. And I kind of left when I was 12 years old. At 10, I had a paper out. At 12, I moved down the road and worked on a farm for $1 a day. And it was better than home. I had room and board and $1 a day. And at 17, I knew that I had to get out of that little town. And I joined the Marine Corps. And things immediately got worse yet. I didn't think they was going to get worse or could get worse. But sure enough, they did. But after I was there for a while, I really liked it. I began to really like the military. First of all, they fixed all my teeth. And that was really neat, not having that constant pain in your head all the time. And then they cut off all your hair, and they cut off everybody, so it didn't make any difference what it looked like anymore. So you felt a little less conscious of that. And then they give you nice clothes, and the clothes were the same as everybody else's. So for the first time in my life, I felt just like, and looked like, just like everybody else. And of course, I wasn't just like everybody else, because I was just a tad crazy. And from living in the city park and coming out of that kind of home, you're not too well emotionally. And you're usually not too spiritual, and you're usually not too well educated. And I was none of those things. So they immediately sent me overseas, and the one thing that I never had in my home was love. And I really wanted somebody to love me. And I found out, I was sent to Japan right after I went into service, and I found out that you could get somebody to love you for $3. I got to say, I enjoyed that experience, even though I had a tremendous amount of guilt, because I knew I could see my purgatory time picking up. You know, I'd never had enough quarters to wipe the slate clean after that. When I got back to the States, and I missed that right away. That was one of the things that I missed, and I knew that I had to find a girlfriend, and I had to get married, and so I went looking for one. And as soon as I got back, it was the first weekend I was back, and we was out seeking, as Bruce says, we were seeking sex and whatever. And these girls were, we met them at a restaurant, and there was a tall girl there, and she was, I thought she was cute, and I says to the guys, that one's mine. You know, and I walked up to her and I said, you know, I've been around the world looking for you. And and she didn't buy that right off. But I had made a decision right then that was the person I was going to marry. And after that, it was just a question of convincing her of that necessity. And I wrote my mother a letter even that very night, and I told my mother that I was going to get married, and I just met the girl that I was going to marry. And we had a real rocky relationship. She liked to drink wine. Her mother drank a lot of wine, but she was a cheap date, and I really liked that, too. We'd stop by the liquor store and go through the wicker basket out front and pick out the old dusty wine bottles for 97 cents and go to the beach. And that was a terrific thing for me, because we didn't have a whole lot of money when we was in the service. After we'd been gone together for a year or so, we went to the Marine Corps ball, and she thought that she could outdrink the Marines, and she tried. And she went out on the dance floor by herself, and you know, and she did all kinds of things. But the worst thing that happened to her that night was she got herself pregnant. And she was really resentful about that, because she didn't remember, she thought it was my fault. You see, that date drug that they're talking about now, we've always had that. That's nothing new. One that they're talking about coming in Florida. Date rape drug, you heard about that? We've always had that. So we got married. This was in the 50s, and the thing to do back then was to get married. If you didn't, your child would not have a name, and they would stamp bastard on his birth certificate. That's what everybody was told. So we got married. I hadn't convinced her yet at this time that she liked me. And she really didn't. But I really needed her. I mean, I really needed her. And she always drank funny. We would go to a party, and I would call her and say, well, we've been invited over to so-and-so's house tonight. You want to go? And she would always say, yeah, I'll go. And when I'd get home to get dressed to go to the party, she was already drunk. And I'd say, you're drunk already. She said, well, I'm getting ready for the party. And I always thought that was a little unusual. And I thought, well, you're not going to be able to drink much at the party. You're just going to pass out, aren't you? And she said, no, I won't. And I said, okay. And she didn't. She would go to the party, and she'd drink for a while, and then she'd go out back and stick her finger down her throat, and she'd throw it up. She'd come in and drink some more. And I thought, that's a little bizarre. But I didn't think it was that unusual. She was Irish, you know. So we had the baby, and we was going to separate right after the baby was born, because we really didn't get along very well. Her mother was alcoholic, and we knew absolutely nothing about having a relationship. We knew nothing about life. We knew nothing about nothing. And the only thing that we knew for sure was that we could never go home. So after that little baby was born, we decided that we were going to stay together no matter what. It was a decision that we made, a pact that we made. People say you can't make decisions like that, but if you're sick enough, you can. And so we made that decision. When I was out of the Marine Corps, I wanted to move back to Indiana. God knows why, but I did. I felt home calling me. I hadn't had any dirt between my toes for a long time. I'd missed the smell of the pigs. I just felt like I had to come back home. And so we moved back with Shrimp Decatur. We moved back to the big city, Fort Wayne, because she was a city girl. And I got a little job at Essex Wire, and her father had been an engineer, and I started coming home in dirty clothes, and I was making $80 a week, and she said, you know, I really can't live like this. If you're going to live with me, you're going to have to go to school. So I said, well, what do you want me to take? And she said, well, my father was an engineer. Why don't you do that? And I said, well, if that's what you want, you know. And I started out with the ICS course. And, of course, with my previous education, reading and writing was one of the couple of things I missed. And But she would come in and how do I phrase this nice? She'd come in and bitch at me. I would keep asking her, how do you spell this and how do you spell that and, you know, and that thing. Anyway, she helped me a lot with the schooling. And after we got about half done with the schooling, she said, why are we here, Indiana? She says, you don't have an ocean. You don't have any mountains. You don't have any pretty lakes. There's nothing to do here. Your family's all crazy. We have nothing to do with your family. What the hell are we doing here? Couldn't come up with an argument. Not a one. And I said, well, your family's no weller than my family. And I'm not going to go back to Rhode Island. I hate Rhode Island. And so we went out and we bought our first big book. It was a Rand McNally with all the 50 states. And we looked through there, and I had my compass, and they have the United States map up front, and I drew a little arcs to see what was exactly the middle so we could be fair between her parents and where we was. And it was Western New York, and it looked beautiful. You could see they had mountains there and, you know, and little trout streams and stuff. You could see all that stuff in the map. And it was the end of January, and so we decided to go. And we owed the county government a little money, and the sheriff was after us, and we didn't have any tires for the car, and I went to the dump, and we got some tires that looked better than the ones I had, and we put them on the car. And we headed for this little town that was right directly in the middle of her parents and my parents, within 20 miles. And it happened to be in western New York, about 60 miles south of Buffalo. And when we got up there, the snow was about 3 foot deep, and it didn't show any snow on the map. You got to be careful of that stuff. And it was about 15 degrees below zero all winter, and it was awful. It sure made Indiana look good. And first month we was there, she said, I can't live here. This is just too cold, and it's just too miserable. And she started to drink a little bit more, and she was awful lonely, and there was nobody there that we knew. And so I said, well, where do you want to go? And she said, well, if we can go just a little further south, you know. But if we go south here, we'll still be in the mountains. So we have to go a little bit further west, a little bit further south. And we got the book out again, and it looked like Massillon, Ohio was right around the corner from there, right down around the hill. So we moved to Massillon, Ohio, packed everything up in the U-Haul, and this is really sick to say, back in those days, we had the two kids to travel with, and we always had a dog and a cat. We always had pets. And she'd say, well, what do we do with the dog and the cat? And they won't travel well. And so when we got ready to go, I'd just go out and finish off the dog and the cat, put them in the trash can, and we'd get on the road. That's the kind of mind I had at that time, though. That's how crazy I was. I didn't care about anything or anybody. The only thing that I had in my life was my wife and these two little kids. And I knew that my family, we could never go back there, and we could never go back to her family. And that was the only thing we had in common, was that we could never go home. Until we just started to drift. And we went to Ohio, and as soon as we got there, we got a new house. And we would always sell off the appliances and everything, just have a yard sale, just put everything out the front and just sell it all off. That was our motto, buy high and sell low. And things really move quick like that. You don't have to spend a lot of time. And so we got set up in our house down in Ohio, and I got another job, and it was a pretty good job. And we was there about 2 weeks, and she said, the air smells funny here. I don't think I'll ever be happy here. And I said, I don't care. You're staying. God, I'm getting tired of this, and you're staying. She said, no, I'm not. I said, yes, you are. 6 months later, we head out to Big Book again, and because she had a vision. My wife, when she was drinking, she had visions. Not all alcoholics have visions, but people would come and talk to her. I mean, people would come talk to her all the time. And she had a group of people from the past who were spirits that came to visit her, and they told her that she was just born too late, and she really belonged out west, and she should have been on a wagon train, but she missed it all. And so I said, where do you want to go? Where should we be? Because I'd do anything to keep her happy, because if she wasn't happy, I wasn't happy. And if we wasn't happy, we took it out on the kids, and none of us were happy. And life was just misery, and we were always suicidal and homicidal anyway. So we got out to Big Book again, and we started looking out west, and if you go too far west, you get into the mountains. And we'd already been in mountains in New York. We knew what that was like. We wouldn't gone that far. And if you didn't go far enough, it still seemed like you was back home. So you had to go beyond Missouri. So we picked out Kansas. We moved to Kansas. Moved to Wichita, Kansas. First summer, we got there in June. The first week, it went up to 105. And the dust storm started. And she said, I just got the pictures up again, just got the drapes up. And she looked at me and she said, I can't stand it here. I'm never going to be happy. And I said, I don't care. You're staying. By God, you got us all the way out here. This is where we're supposed to be. It's out west and we're staying. She said, no, we're not. A year and a half later, we was on our way to Toledo. And we had a wreck in Terre Haute, by the way. We'd lost all our furniture and everything in Terre Haute. I had a big double axle U-Haul trailer jackknifed, and I dumped it all up the road up here. But we got to Toledo, and when we got to Toledo, we noticed that the sun never come out. I'm sure that it does come out sometime, but not in the 6 weeks that we were there. So she called her parents and she said, Dad, you got to come and get me. I'm dying out here. And she was real suicidal, and she wanted to die, and she always wanted to die. And she always said that, because every time she said that, I'd buy her a bottle of vodka. And alcoholics catch on to that stuff quick. And so her dad come and got her, and I packed up the furniture, and I followed a couple of days later. And we went back to Rhode Island. So that's where we started from. Now we'd made a full circle. And this only took altogether 7 years. We'd made a full circle. And her mother was a practicing alcoholic. And she drank a gallon of wine a day. And she always drank a gallon of wine. She always said she wasn't alcoholic because she mixed it with ice. And Wine wasn't that strong, and it was watered down anyway. And my wife started doing that. But my wife wasn't as good at it as she was. And after a year and a half of that, a gallon of wine a day, she started getting a little flakier than she was even before. And then her father died, and her grandfather died a month ago, and we was out at the graveyard, and she got pneumonia. And when we got back to the house, she had to go to bed, and when she went to bed, she was away from the wine. She got DTs, and she went nuts. She was seeing snakes and bugs all over, and she was in the fetal position in the middle of the bed just screaming, which was unusual for her. She was just in the middle of the bed sleeping. So I thought, this is something new. And I called the doctor, and he come out, and he just kind of looked around the door and said, she's just like her mother. And he come in, and he give her a shot of Valium. And I didn't know that alcoholism was just a Valium deficiency up till then. And she, and then, of course, that wasn't quite enough. And then we started out to the psychiatrist. And the first psychiatrist told her that it was my fault. And he was an old German tank driver that escaped somehow after the war. And we went to him for 3 or 4 months, and she got about a shoebox full of pills from him. And then he got arrested. He got in a fist fight with 2 cops, and they pulled him over for drunk driving. And so we didn't go to him anymore. And we went to the second one, and the second one said it was her mother's fault, and they had to go back to her childhood. And she picked up another box of pills from him. So she had 2 shoeboxes full of different kinds of things, virtually a zombie by then. And this went on for 4 years. And during that period of time, she would sleep almost all day long. I would come home at night, I would pick her up out of bed and bring her out, and I would set her in the living room and turn on the TV, and she had a rocking chair. I'd set her in this rocking chair. And I'd turn on the TV, and I'd go make something to eat for me and the kids, and I would feed her some soup or make her a toasted cheese or something, help her eat it. She couldn't, her hands would shake so bad she couldn't raise her hand to her mouth anymore. And this was back in the 70s. And during that period of time, we'd moved 4 times in Rhode Island for all kinds of different reasons. I mean, big reasons. First time we moved to get away from her mother, we moved 20 miles away. But unfortunately, we moved in this house that had the wrong kind of radiators, and they were driving my wife crazy. And she thought there was evil things coming out of the radiators. So we sold the house, and we carried this stuff 50 yards up the street to another house that had a different kind of radiators. And me and the 2 boys hauled everything up the street. And then she went to the last psychiatrist that was out there. And he said, what we need is behavior modification. And she says, let's get the hell out of here. And so we got out to Dream Book again. During that period of time, we'd moved 4 times in Rhode Island for all kinds of different reasons. I mean, big reasons. First time we moved to get away from her mother, and we moved 20 miles away. But unfortunately, we moved in this house that had the wrong kind of radiators, and they were driving my wife crazy. And she thought there was evil things coming out of the radiators. So we sold the house, and we carried this stuff 50 yards up the street to another house that had a different kind of radiators. And me and the 2 boys hauled everything up the street. And then she went to the last psychiatrist that was out there. And he said, what we need is behavior modification. And she says, let's get the hell out of here. and so we got out to Dream Book again. And Walter Cronkite came on TV, and he said, the most livable city in the country is Tulsa, Oklahoma. And she said, God, if we can be happy, we could be happy in the most livable city. It's got to be just great there. Let's go there. And I said, okay, we'll go there. So we packed up our stuff and moved from Rhode Island to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we got out there, and we was there for the same deal, bought a new house, new furniture, new appliances, all that stuff. And we moved in, and we was there about 2 weeks, and she says, I think this was a big mistake. I can't stand it here. I'm not going to live here. And I said, this time you're staying. I don't care. By then, my son was into drugs. My oldest boy was into drugs and alcohol. And he would steal and get whatever he could, wherever he could get it from. And there was no limit to what he would do with it. And he would do it with no thought of his own destruction. And at that time, I had to start following him. I would pick him up out of the gutter. I'd pick him up out of the yard. I'd pick him up at school. And he would always be so far out of it that I would always have to, it was just like he was dead when I'd find him. And I'd have to close his mouth and shut his eyes to keep the flies from getting in his mouth and the sun from burning out his eyes. And I would take him home, put him to bed. And I had him in one room, and I had her in another. And I didn't realize that if the mother and father are crazy, and they live a completely, totally crazy lifestyle, that the kids will too. You see, that never dawned on me until just a couple years ago, that that's probably what was wrong with them. And, but sure enough, they picked up our behavior patterns. And he took after the Irish side of the family, and he went with his mother. The second child took after my side of the family, and I took after my mother. We were Al-Anon types, and he started to take care of his older brother. And those were the roles that we played. And then we adopted our daughter, because when we got to Oklahoma, because this last psychiatrist had said, if you had a daughter, your problem is that you live with all males. You have no female companionship. And you got a male dog, a male cat, two male sons, and a married man. And so we adopted a little daughter, and we couldn't get a baby. So we got somebody that was 7 years old. And she'd already been through God knows what. And her mother had OD'd on drugs with on glue is what it was, as a matter of fact. And her mother was dead. She had four brothers and sisters. Anyway, we took this little girl in. And the first day that she was there, she just kind of wandered off. And we went and found her and brought her home. And that never changed all the while she lived with us. For the next 10 years, she just kind of wandered off, and I'd go get her and bring her home. But we had her, and at 10 years old, she was starting to have beer parties in the house. And so I had three of them at the same time. And I thought, I'm going to check out of here. I just can't do this anymore. And because I was a Catholic, I couldn't commit suicide. And without going straight to hell, I thought, still just a little chance. I won't go to hell, so I'm not going to do that. And it would break my mother's heart if I did that, so I'll just die. And I had diarrhea real bad when I had depression, and I was always depressed. So I had diarrhea real bad this time, and so I quit eating. And when it was a couple days, sure enough, I was in the hospital. And so I laid up there and tried to die. And I laid there for 23 days, and the water was in my body, and it was an inch from my heart. And they said, you know, if you lay down, you're going to die. And they'd strap me up, so I'd be sitting up straight, and I would lay down, and I'd rip them off and pull the things out of my arms as soon as they went out of the room. And after laying there for 23 days, I had a brilliant thought. This is a stupid place to come to die in a hospital. They're not going to let me die in here. And so I got up, and I said, I called the nurse in, and I said, I need my clothes. I'm going home. I need to get back to work. Things are just getting worse. And I went home, and it took me 6 weeks to recover enough physically that I could get up and go back to work. But I got up and go back to work. And that just continued on. But after that, I didn't care so much, because what I found out in the hospital was that they didn't care. Because when I was laying there and I was almost dead, there was nobody there. They didn't come to visit. They didn't call. They didn't care. So when I went home, I had a different attitude, and I started detachment with no love whatsoever. And my wife started to sink even further. And in the next 3 years, she sank all the way to the bottom. In the last year, she could no longer get up out of bed. She could no longer get up in the daylight. She could no longer go to the door or answer the phone or open the drapes or do any of those things. She was just a zombie. And she lived in the house virtually by herself. The two boys had left. And the daughter was in jail by then. And she was just alone. And naturally, after a period of time, she tried to commit suicide again. And she wound up in a treatment center. And she didn't want to go to a treatment center. She wanted to go. She really didn't want to go to any place sleazy, because we were really above that. I mean, we had a new car. And she didn't want to go to the state funny farm. So that's where she was headed. So she said, I'd rather go any place than there. So she wound up in a treatment center because I had more class. And that's how we started. And I didn't want her to go. And it really made me angry. And I went out there and tried to get her back out because I wanted her to die. I'd had enough of it. And she'd had enough. And over the years, we'd been every place that we could go. We went to all the doctors. We took all the pills. We went all to the marriage counselors. We went to church for a while. We had tried everything, and absolutely nothing worked. And I firmly believed at that time that it was just a matter of time, and why prolong it? Why drag it out another month or two? And I wanted to just come home, try it again, and get out of here. And after she was gone, I was going to go. So I was going to stay alive long enough to take care of her, because I felt responsible for her, and I knew there was nobody else in her life. And as luck would have it, she stayed. And they got her involved in this AA thing, which pissed me off even more. And she would, every time I'd go out there, she'd be hugging on all these guys, and you know, and she was up walking around and stuff. And really irritated me. I mean, that was the first time in all her life that I think I really didn't love her anymore. It just crushed me to see that they was doing for her what I couldn't done, because they were telling me the same things I did. They did the same thing I did. I said, you know, get a job. Get out and get some friends. Meet the neighbors, you know. You can't lay around the house like this. You got to get dressed sometimes, you know. Do something with yourself. Do your hair, you know. And I had all the answers for her, and she just wouldn't listen. And now she went out here with these strangers. They started telling her stuff like that, and she started doing it. And I thought, God, that's strange, you know. And then they introduced me to Al-Anon. And they said, well, they'll have AA in one section of the church, and it was in a little church, and Al-Anon will be another section. And I said, well, how do I know where they are? And they say, oh, you'll find them. So anyway, I knew what the alcoholics were like, because we'd spent a little bit of time in bars and stuff at the low end. So when I got ready to go to my first Al-Anon meeting, I threw my old Louisville Slugger in the back of the truck, and I loaded my pistol and stuck it underneath the seat. Well, I knew the place would be crawling with alcoholics. I knew it. Yeah. And I parked about two blocks away. I drove by the place slow first. I seen all those junk cars out there, and they all had bent-up fenders, and they were painted six colors, you know, typical alcoholic cars. And I had a new truck, and I wasn't going to park there with those guys, I told you that. So I parked two blocks away and walked back. And that was my first meeting. My first meeting, I went in and just sat there and tried to listen, and there was one guy in there, and there was three ladies in there. And the second I walked in there, I felt something that I hadn't felt in just about my whole life, was they loved me right away. I mean, they hugged me when I came in. The tears just started pouring out. I just couldn't. It was just so overwhelming that somebody cared. It was the first people that I'd run across that cared. And I sat there in the first meeting, and I knew right then that my wife wasn't my problem, that the way my father was and the way my family was, and I was just crazy. And they said, keep coming back, and I did. Not right off, because somebody had to sit home. My daughter was in and out of jail, and she was home at the time, so I could only go to one meeting a week, and that wasn't working. But my wife was going to 7-10 meetings a week. And after a couple months of that, she was starting to get a lot better. And what we both had sponsors right off the bat, and what our sponsors did for us was the greatest thing that they could have done for us. And I don't know if anybody does it anymore. What they did was kept us separated. Because we had these brown bags filled with stuff all the way back to our mothers, all this ugly stuff you said and I said, and we did this, and remember when you did that? And we had all that stuff that the first sign of any difficulties, we'd drag all that stuff out and throw it on each other. You know, just pour a 5-gallon bucket of it over the other. And we just literally hated each other at that particular point in time. But we also loved each other. It was your typical love-hate relationship where you hated so much you know, you couldn't stand to be with them, and you loved them so much you couldn't stand to be 10 feet away. And that's the way we was. And they just kept us separated for the first year and a half. She went to meetings with her people, and I went to meetings with my people, and we very rarely ever talked. They talked about early communications, early this, early that. We had early nothing, is what we had. And after we'd been gone for a year and a half, they had this little couples meeting down at one of the clubhouses on Saturday night. And I'd found out that about that, and so did she about the same time, so we decided to go with that. She drove separately, and I drove separately, and I'd sit on one end, and she would sit on the other. And it was the first time that we'd ever communicated. We would communicate by sharing where we were at, how we felt, and stuff in front of the whole group, and of course the other person heard it, who was down at the other end. And that's how our communication started back up. And of course, with our detachment, which is what all Al-Anons do first off, it was difficult for me to learn that because this lady had become a clinging vine the last 15 years. I mean, she couldn't eat, she couldn't do nothing without me. And then just to all of a sudden abandon her was real difficult to do. And of course, I was still miserable and insane and suicidal. And so my sponsor told me to go home on Sunday afternoon and just spend a little time in a bedroom all by myself and see how I felt. And so I did that, and I just went in the bedroom on Sunday afternoon. I spent 2 hours in there, and I just sat in there and cried and thought about how miserable my life was and how about the kids and about all the bad things everybody had said and thought about my mother and thought about all those things and spent the most 2 hours, miserable hours of my entire life. And on Monday night meeting, my sponsor said, "Well, did you do what I asked?" And I said, "Sure I did." And he said, "Well, how'd you feel?" I said, "Most miserable 2 hours of my entire life." And he said, "Who was in there with you?" I said, "Nobody." He said, "The wife wasn't in there? The kids weren't in?" I said, "Nobody was in there." And he said, "Well, I guess you know who's doing it to you then, don't you?" And that's when I first started to learn something. And you hear everybody talk about the steps until it's so boring listening to the steps. And the only reason people talk about them is because they work. And we started out with the old step one. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. Alcoholics knew that. You know, been with it all my life, knew that. Right into life's unmanageable, knew that. God, it couldn't have been any more unmanageable than what it was. And on top of all the other chaos, we kept moving every 3 or 4 months, you know, which just to keep up the anxiety while nothing else was going on. And we got the insanity part was no problem. Got up to step three, and all that stuff flooded back from my childhood. I said, "Don't think I'm ever going to be able to do this one. You know, this is something I'll just have to bypass." Jumped right on to step four. Made my fearless moral inventory of all my character defects, and I still remember it to this day. And I poured everything I had into that. All my problems were caused because I was too kind. I was too loyal. I was too loving. I was too all these things because if I wouldn't have been like that, I wouldn't have been with all these sick people and they wouldn't have been able to do that to me. My sponsor got a big kick out of that when I read him that. Anyway, that was the best I could do at the time. And we did that. And that turn over your will and your life to the care of God, that just wasn't going to happen right then. And I went to ACA meetings, Al-Anon ACA meetings for the next 2.5 years. I went to 3 different meetings a week. And I finally got through that, and I finally put that in the past where it belongs, and I forgot about that, and that's gone. And at the same time I was doing that, of course, I could put away a lot of the old religious stuff that I had and find a God at my own understanding, and I did that by reading books like God Calling, Emmett Fox, all the Al-Anon literature, and everything I could get a hold of. There's more literature out there, folks, than just the books that they give you here, and I'd suggest that you read some of it, whatever's right for you. But through the next couple of years, I got through that, and steps 4 through 9, just get up the early, the old-timers, believe that God talks to you, that God actually gives you guidance. And that step 11 is the first time you'll notice where that comes into play. Because as long as your heart's filled with hate, and as long as you have all those resentments, and as long as you have all the fear, and as long as you have all the anger, you're not going to be able to hear God. It's not going to work. So by the time you get down to step 10 and you start just reviewing 4 through 9 that you've already done, and then you get on to step 11, you pray for guidance. By then, hopefully, you're walking with God just a little bit occasionally. And as you do that, as you walk with God, you look for what God's will may be for you. And I think that's the time when you actually start looking for, what is God's will for me? What does he really want me to do? And you can start out with some of the simple things, because it's been known for generations what God wants you to do. First of all, he wants you to take care of yourself. He wants you to be healthy. He wants you to exercise. He wants you to eat good food. He wants you to be moderate in your living. He wants you to take care of yourself, take care of your body. That's a pretty simple one. I started out with that one. I started a running program. I started an exercise program. I started an eating good program. I started moderation. I quit smoking. Don't be offended. But I thought that was important for my recovery. And then as I look for God's will for me, and the way I understand it, you can tell when you're living in God's will because you're in harmony with God. And you can actually hear God speak with you. And you can actually live and walk with God. And you can tell when you're in harmony with God when everything's okay. And I found out that God didn't want me to be an evangelist or any of those things. He just wants me to go to work every day and bring home a paycheck and be nice to my kids and be a good father and a good husband and do whatever I can for the program to help pay back all that's been given to me. And if you would have seen me the first day, and my wife, when we first got here, you would not believe it, the change that we went through. My son has been through 3 psych wards. He's sober at the time, at this moment, been sober about 80 days again. And he's the Irish, the one that takes after the Irish side of the family. And it appears that he's going to be okay. I think he's finally catching on. And my daughter, she travels with a Murphy Brothers spare. She's a carny. And for her, that's good. If you would have seen where she came from and where she was at from the years when she was 15 through 20, and you would have known that this is good. And she has a couple children, and she's a good mother, and she stays sober, and she does the inventory control, and she does the payroll for the fair, and they're her people. And she loves them, and she's a part of them, and she's doing just fine. We're very proud of her. And she calls every month or so just to say that she loves us. And we are moving next month back to Oklahoma because our oldest son, well, we've been there for a year and a half. But our oldest son has got, he was sober again. And we couldn't live around him when he was drunk. Just couldn't do that. And we had to get out of the way. And we got out of the way and he made some new friends. And he started going to the little clubhouse in the town, and because we were the last ones that he would ever listen to. And so we just got out of the way. But now he has 2 beautiful children, and we've become real close. We talk together all weekends on the phones. And we bought a house that's a half a block down the street from them. Don't know how that'll work out. But we're giving up what we're doing. This is going to be our last move.
Come back to me.
We've been married 37 years, and this is our 28th move. And we really enjoyed Phoenix, and it's beautiful out there for anybody who ever wants to go out there, except from July through October. Forget it. Don't even drive through. Take the northern route. Stay out of there. But we have truly loved this program. My wife is an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My son is an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My daughter's doing well. I'm doing well. We walk with God. We have no fear. We have no fear of going back. We have no fear of finding work. We have no fear of anything. We just watch life unfold in front of us and watch God work in our life. And that's the way our lives are working now. When we first made the decision that we'd probably move back to Oklahoma, and my wife made the decision first, and she tells me about it later. But we really didn't have enough money to do that. And her mother, who was a practicing alcoholic for, she was 79 years old, and this past January, she died. We got a call that she had died. And we went up to empty, to go up and, the barrier and clean up the house. And my wife had the opportunity to love her those last 10 years when she was purely unlovable, because she learned in the program certainly about the disease and that it was not anything to hate or despise. And she loved her mother. And she always thought about the good times that they'd had when she was a kid. We got up there, and there was 14 empty gallon wine jugs on the counter. There was no food in the house at all, not one scrap of food. There was more wine jugs right outside the front door. There were 62 of them all together, empty 1 gallon wine jugs. And she'd went outside and slipped on the ice in the front door and fell and hit her head and froze to death in the driveway. And the two girls were okay with that. You know, they'd done all they could. They asked her. She didn't want to change her behavior. Not everyone gets called the Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of you that are here can thank God that you're here. Because I have watched my father die, and I watched my mother-in-law die. I watched people die from this disease. And it's not a pretty thing. Not a pretty thing. And I'm sure that God walks with each and every one of us in here. And will continue to do that as long as we do his work. Thank you.